We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
A fine holiday week for you both.
Yes, nice and restful.
Very good. I wanted to just give a quick update to the status at the station, as we had reported last week, that we only have our space remaining here until the 31st, and then we were being booted out onto the street. So I just want to let you know that the over-the-air signal will be officially turned off on Monday, the morning of the 28th. This is being recorded Saturday. So we will continue to broadcast in streaming format until we can find a new home. So there'll probably be a little bit of disruption Monday morning as we grab the streaming server and run it across town. And it's kind of sad being in here doing the last official broadcast from our university district bunker. So with that, speaking of bunkers, or at least the ones that people are more familiar with, the OPA, the Office of Public
Police Accountability.
Professional accountability.
Professional.
They didn't even say police, yes.
No, they changed it to Office of Police Accountability.
Oh, did they?
Yeah,
okay.
It was originally the Office of Professional Accountability, and it was located within the Seattle Police Department and had very limited capability to investigate and address police reform issues. Now
it still does.
It's located near the Seattle Police Department. It's supposed to be somewhat independent, but it has a bit more power to investigate police reform issues. But because it's led by and mostly staffed by Seattle police officers or former Seattle police or former police officers, it tends to side with the police on most reform.
Yeah, and they really review internal police investigations. They don't have the ability to independently investigate complaints, in terms of like subpoenaing police officers, that kind of thing. So it's very limited. But on Wednesday, they released a couple of reports saying that the large number of complaints that they got from protesters this summer around Black Lives Matter protests, they had sort of subdivided those complaints into categories, and there were at least reports on a couple of them. One of them, they determined that police covering their badge numbers with tape was not a violation of policy because they were doing it to memorialize a recently deceased officer. Now, the only officer in the Seattle area that has died this year was in Bainbridge in April. So that's something of a stretch. But
and there's a city ordinance that forbids covering the badge number.
Yes, but for some reason, OPA determined that was not a violation of either law or policy. The other thing that was not a violation was keeping their body cams off while they brutalized and attacked protesters. And those are very clear violations of city ordinances. Why OPA determined that they were not violations is an open question, but it really underscores that OPA is kind of useless when it comes to actual civilian oversight of police, of the Seattle Police Department. And when we get to our summaries in a minute of underreported stories this year, a lot of them are going to deal with the fact that SPD is basically unaccountable and out of control. And that finding just underscores it. It was very discouraging.
Yeah, and I think it was just a few weeks ago that the Black Lives Matter Seattle King County sent a letter to Mayor Durkan and the city council saying, hey, there's an issue with the OPA. It's not doing its job. And they're right. And this is clear evidence that they're right.
Merry Christmas.
Well, speaking of which, it being the holidays and the end of the year, we regularly do. You two regularly do a summary of all the overhyped and underreported stories.
We have been doing this, God help us, for 26 years now, I think.
Yes, we have.
Yeah, so we have a lot of underreported stories this year because obviously there was a ton of news and, you know, important news tended to get buried just because there was so much else going on. Maria, do you want to start in on your list?
No. Yeah, I'll start in on my list and you can chime in, Job.
Sure.
A lot of my list, it's heavily dominated by Seattle Police Department antics. And it's just been that kind of a year. But we're going to start out first with Mayor Jenny Durkan's irresponsible budget fights with the city council, because I think that's the most important underreported story of the year. The mayor withholding money in the 2020 budget for expanding the money was budgeted, but she wouldn't spend it for expanding the LEED program. She didn't spend $1.8 million for tiny homes for the homeless to get people off the street. She wouldn't spend $1 million for rapid rehousing of Native American homeless folks. And she refused to spend $700,000 for rent subsidies for disabled people over the age of 50. That was money that was budgeted in the 2020 budget last year. Then she refused to include these programs in the 2020 budget revision. So clearly she was trying to write them out of 2020. And when the council added them back, then made what we determined were very modest cuts to the Seattle Police Department budget, Durkan petulantly vetoed that revised 2020 budget, saying it was irresponsible to spend money to help people in need while cutting fat in the Seattle Police Department. Durkan also vetoed the council's COVID-19 relief bill, and she separately vetoed their effort to raise revenue with the Jumpstart Seattle payroll tax on businesses, and the council overturned her veto every time, and they did it overwhelmingly. Yet mainstream local media continues to portray the city council as the irresponsible one and refuses to take a serious look at Mayor Durkan and her inability to govern.
And I would sort of tag on to that. One of my items for underreported is one of the major reasons that Durkan is not running for reelection is that the business community in Seattle has largely abandoned their support for her. Of course, she was originally elected in 2017 with a huge amount of PAC money from the Seattle Chamber and Amazon and all those folks. And they would not write a check for her this time.
Yeah.
That's
very true. Just up until a couple weeks ago, all she had was about $5,000 in her reelection campaign account.
And that really has not been reported locally. And certainly the reasons why have not been reported locally. I mean, she's getting it from both sides. She's getting it from the business community that are very upset that she has not had a handle on the protests this year. And, kept downtown cheery and open and all the rest of it, especially during the pandemic. And then she's also been a target of resignation calls from, community groups and protesters and all the rest of that, too. And
yeah.
I think that was another one of your underreported stories.
Yeah, that's further down the list. I reported that two of the city's advisory commissions called for Mayor Durkan to resign this year. In October, both the Seattle Human Rights Commission and, I think more damaging, the Seattle LGBTQ Commission released letters calling for Mayor Durkan to resign. And if she wouldn't do it, for the city council to remove her from office. The Seattle LGBTQ Commission said that they had tried for months to work with Durkan's office on police violence during the summer's protests. And the SPD's use of tear gas and pepper spray in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, which has a primarily LGBTQ demographic, right? But Durkan's office wouldn't respond until after the commission put a vote on their agenda calling for her resignation. Then Durkan herself wouldn't meet with them. She actually sent her deputy mayor, Shefali Ranganathan, to speak with the commission, which was really typical of how Durkan has operated throughout her term. She won't do these things herself. She sends her staff members out to do important work that she probably should be doing herself. And I think the fact that the LGBTQ Commission joined the Human Rights Commission calling for her to resign was particularly damaging because Durkin identifies as lesbian. So to see them, the LGBTQ Commission call for her resignation just had to be a major psychological blow for her, but also a blow for a lot of folks who supported her for that reason. And yet there, again, there was barely a mention of this in the mainstream press.
Okay.
So, and then number two on my list was a historic change in the way the city negotiates police union contracts. In late January, the city council quietly voted to pass a resolution to raise police accountability issues during the upcoming negotiations with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, whose contract expires at the end of this year. That resolution said that the council would support the priorities and recommendations of the Community Police Commission, the Office of Inspector General for Public Safety, and the Office of Police Accountability. And then in mid-November, Mayor Durkin and council member Lisa Herbold, who has been chair of the Public Safety Committee on the City Council throughout this year, announced a major change in who gets to sit at the negotiating table when the city bargains the new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. Instead of just representatives of the mayor's office, as there's been in the past, and the city's Labor Relations Policy Committee, there will now be members of the three oversight bodies, including the Community Police Commission. So this is really the first time that members representing the community will have input into the police officers' union contract. In addition, a member of the city council's central staff will also be present at the negotiations. The council will no longer have to rely solely on secondhand information provided by representatives from the mayor's office. And that's a big change. And I think we're going to see that in the terms that come out of the negotiations on the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract this coming year.
So the problem with the past negotiations with the SPOG contracts is they've been reliant on the mayor's office and going back through Durkin and Ed Murray and, you know, Mike McGinn and all the past mayors. The city has not asked for reform measures to be incorporated in the SPOG contract. They really haven't pushed for it. And so those contracts have been a major sticking point for the reform process. And hopefully now with community people and in city council representatives at the table, you know, you'll have a much more targeted push for some of the reform measures that the city council has already passed, but have not been incorporated in the contracts and therefore haven't been implemented.
Yeah. And it's been a major issue, particularly during the Durkin administration, because she, in the last contract negotiations, her office bargained away some of the major police reforms that the city council passed in the last ordinance that they passed to implement police reform in Seattle, particularly when it came towards disciplinary proceedings against officers accused of excessive force. And I guess that's something we can expect from Mayor Durkin, having been a public prosecutor, that she would side with the police on those issues. But if once you have representatives of the police accountability bodies, the Community Police Commission, the Office of Police Accountability, and the Office of Inspector General for the police department, that you will have some folks sitting at the table pushing for those disciplinary measures to be included in the union contract. So that's a major change and a very hopeful one.
Yes, and Durkin also had very strong support from SPOG when she was elected in 2017.
Yeah. Yeah. And notably, again, she apparently doesn't have their support anymore. So let's move on to number three on my list. Proving that police accountability isn't just a problem in Seattle, King County voters passed all three charter amendments that relate to police reform for the King County Sheriff's Department this year during the November election. And they passed them overwhelmingly. And those three charter amendments included things like allowing the Office of Law Enforcement Oversight to issue subpoenas to get access to witnesses, documents, and evidence, changing the King County Sheriff to an appointed position instead of an elected one, and making the King County Executive the person who negotiates the contract renewals and working conditions with law enforcement unions instead of the King County Sheriff. Yes.
and I would
the King County Sheriff.
I would add to that that in past years, pretty routinely, we've had as part of our underreported stories that King County Sheriff's Office has been really problematic in terms of its use of force and other complaints. It's not just SPD. KCSO has also been seriously problematic for a number of years. And that really goes back to the original initiative in which the sheriff became an elected position about 20 years ago, and it has not worked out well. So that's going to be a major change.
Yeah, and one of the big problems with having the sheriff be an elected position, you would think, oh, more accountability to voters, right? But the problem there is that then the candidates for King County Sheriff have to live within the county, right? And that means members of the King County Sheriff's Office are the only ones really qualified to run for that position. So you never, ever get any fresh blood in from outside to run the department, and that's been a major issue.
Yeah, and when the culture of the department is itself a problem, yeah. You know, having internal candidates is not going to solve that problem.
It's not going to help, no. So number four on my list is the mainstream press largely ignored the release of the OPA, OIG, and CPC reports on the Seattle Police Department's use of crowd control weapons and the ensuing court battles this summer, which just have not gone well for the city and the Seattle Police Department. Now, all three bodies that we've been talking about, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of the Inspector General for the Police Department, and the Community Police Commission, have recommended major changes to the Seattle Police Department's use of force policies. And all three affirmed that SPD lacks effective crowd control policies and is not well trained to handle demonstrations. The former court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bobb, chimed in. He agreed with that assessment, saying in his resignation letter this year that the SPD's response to protests this summer had been demoralizing to him, and that he thought the Seattle Police Department had backslid, and that their use of force against protesters had cost the department goodwill with the public. He then released a separate report saying that the SPD should ban the use of tear gas altogether, rewrite its crowd control policies, train its officers how to properly use other crowd control weapons to minimize injuries to demonstrators, and remind its officers that street demonstrations are a legally protected form of free speech, and that police should be on the street to protect protesters' free speech rights, not to brutalize demonstrators. He also condemned the way SPD has treated journalists and medics during this summer's protests. And finally, Black Lives Matter, Seattle, King County, and the ACLU sued the city of Seattle over the SPD's use of tear gas, blast balls, rubber bullets, and pepper spray on peaceful protesters. They won an initial court order to ban the use of these weapons, and then they had to go back to court twice to ask the judge to hold the city and the Seattle Police Department in contempt of court because the SPD would not change their use of these crowd control weapons against peaceful protesters. And finally, in early December, U.S. District Court Judge Richard Jones ruled that the city of Seattle is in contempt of his court order that the Seattle Police Department not use these weapons indiscriminately against peaceful protesters. All of this happened outside of the gaze of the mainstream press, which has continued to portray peaceful demonstrators as hooligans and criminals, to focus very narrowly on the little bit of property destruction that has happened, and particularly demonize acts of very minor acts of violence like spraying graffiti, for example. And the mainstream press has continued to ridicule the city council for also attempting to ban the use of crowd control weapons by the Seattle Police Department. So I think it's just, I think it's horrendous how the Seattle Times and some of our local TV stations have, covered this story or not covered this story in most cases.
I would add to that that one of my items was that SPD has been routinely ignoring court orders in terms of how to handle these demonstrations. It really has been an out-of-control department. It has not been answerable to the courts. It has not been answerable to the mayor. It has not been answerable to city council. It's really been a rogue department this year.
And the press has not held their feet to the fire as they should.
No, you would not know that at all from local media coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So number five on my list is Get Thee Behind Me, the King County Labor Council expelling the Seattle Police Officers Guild and the Seattle School Board voting to expel SPD officers from Seattle schools. So the fallout from the SPD's actions this summer has been widespread, with the King County Labor Council voting to expel the police officers union from the Labor Council. That was the work of many progressive union members this year. Representatives from over 150 union locals voted to expel SPOG. Some folks argued, however, that unions must stick together and that workers have the right to control their working conditions. However, there are limits to that, and the King County Labor Council agreed that the limit is a simple one. You can't bargain for the right to commit a crime and get away with it. That would mean that you're no longer a union. It means you're a criminal gang instead.
And it's interesting because the history of police unions only goes back to the 60s. They started in Detroit as a pushback against the urban riots of the 1960s. And, you know, police unions are now a major impediment, not just in Seattle, but in a lot of major cities across the country, to any kind of police reform. And so that that precedent of expelling them from the AFL-CIO affiliate in King County is a really important one. One was watched in a lot of parts of the country.
Yeah, and then in June, a unanimous vote by the Seattle School Board put their partnership with the Seattle Police Department on indefinite hold. That partnership has involved stationing 5 Seattle Police Department officers in Central and South Seattle schools that have racially diverse student bodies, including South Shore PK through 8, Aki Kurosi Middle School, Denny International Middle School, Washington Middle School, and Garfield High School. So that program is also on hold, indefinite hold now, while the Seattle Police Department continues to brutalize demonstrators. So that was big news this year, and we didn't see a whole lot of reporting on that either. Also on my list this year, the revised 2020 budget and the new 2021 budget show that we have a city council that is determined to cut the Seattle Police Department's budget, but it's going to be a multi-year staged process done in stages. It's going to take time, and it's going to be done with due consideration of what resources communities of color need instead of just men and women with guns on the street. And I'd have to say, shockingly, we're one of the very few places in the United States right now where this process is happening at all. So I think we're going to be one of the early models for the rest of the country, and that may be why, and I think is probably why the city council is moving very carefully and in stages on this process.
And so, despite the pushback from the right wing on this, mm-hmm. we're allowing crime to run rampant, blah, 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 it really is a rethinking of what constitutes public safety and what the best approaches are for public safety. Because there are a lot of, we ask police officers in modern law enforcement to do an impossible job. They're basically a social safety net because we underfund social safety net programs. So we ask police officers, to respond to mental health issues, for example, to respond to substance abuse issues. And they're not trained for that. And the question is, okay, what are the best ways to respond to those kind of issues that don't involve sending people into the field with guns whose first impulse is to try and control the situation by force? And we've seen how that can go sideways in a lot of different cases. And again, it really disproportionately impacts people of color as well in communities of color. And it really erodes the public trust in those communities in our police departments. And we've very much seen that in Seattle. It's been a problem for decades here. It's a long overdue process.
So hand in hand with cutting money to the Seattle Police Department has been this participatory budgeting process by taking community input to try to determine what resources are needed to address these issues of what you could call community safety, but I think are addressing deep concerns of gaps in funding and gaps in just basic human infrastructure for communities of color because of historical institutional racism, that it's really a long overdue process to identify what those gaps are and to try to find the funding for those. That's a process that's going to take a little while. And while there were people on the left who were impatient and wanted to see a 50% cut to the Seattle Police Department this year, and there were folks on the right who were appalled that there were any cuts made to the Seattle Police Department, I think because the city council got flack from both sides means they're probably walking the right path.
It really will take time. And
it's going to take time.
They're doing it thoughtfully, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. So, and that's not something you're hearing from the mainstream press. I think you're only hearing it from us, actually. And then also on my list this year was the backlash against homeless encampments. Nobody can argue that the city isn't undergoing a huge backlash right now against both the homeless and homeless encampments. After seeing Como run yet another Our City is Dying kind of special on TV, like they did just a couple of weeks ago. Como, of course, is owned by the conservative Sinclair Broadcasting Corporation, but their message has been echoed in the Seattle Times and on other news channels and also in the national press, not all of which are conservative outlets. And there are three main reasons for this backlash. One is that the city council passed a new jumpstart payroll tax on businesses, which will eventually be used to get homeless people housed and to build affordable housing. Business people want those things to happen, but they don't want to have to pay for them. That should sound familiar to people, right? Now, the second reason is that the city council voted in February to expand the number of sanctioned encampments in the city from a limit of 8 to an upper limit of 40, and they lifted the requirement that those encampments had to move every 2 years. And then finally, the city council voted to cut funding for the navigation team, a city program that was uniquely responsive to businesses' requests to sweep homeless encampments. And cutting the navigation team, I think, was the final straw. Now we're starting to see the full-on backlash, including a demonization of the homeless and the city council that I think is without precedent this year. And
I think that's going to be very much a factor in the mayoral race next year.
And this is a year in which homelessness is growing even more acute. The one night count of the homeless in February showed two troubling trends that I think are continuing throughout the COVID pandemic. One is a 53% increase in the number of homeless families counted, so parents with children, and a 52% increase in the number of chronically homeless people on the street, with chronically homeless being defined as someone who is homeless for more than 1 year or more than four times in the last 3 years and who suffers from a chronic health condition. This year, those two numbers are expected to be much, much higher when the next count is done this coming February with the COVID-19 crisis.
I'd seen something where they were canceling this coming year's count.
Yeah, it's possible. But you don't have to send people around to count the number of folks in homeless encampments to get a sense of a growing population of people living on the street. We're going to talk about this later. Once important federal programs expire at the end of the year, and once rent moratoriums and rental eviction moratoriums expire, I think a lot more people are going to be out on the street. So, and then I've got a couple more things on my list. I'm going to go through them pretty quickly. Durkin signed an executive order in January to implement the Green New Deal, but then she wouldn't fund it. She said it was because of COVID-19, but I think it kind of went to this aspect of Mayor Durkin, how she thought the Green New Deal legislation passed by the city council was more just for show than for a real action. The city council, of course, came to the rescue and added money back into the 2020 revised budget. And I want to say thank you to Shama Sawant for that, to begin setting up a new Green New Deal advisory board to actually begin work on that. And then my final on the list was SPD sets up a new community response group. The new interim Seattle Police Department Chief Adrian Diaz's move to try to respond to calls for community-led public safety. However, when the press asked him, what is the new community response group going to do? He said it's a unit that's outside of the precinct structure that can roam all over the city to respond to emergencies, like protests, for example. So essentially it was a new response group to squash demonstrations. That's essentially his response to the idea of community-led public safety. So, and of course that wasn't played up in the mainstream media. They said, look, our new interim chief is trying to deal with community-led public safety.
It's heartwarming.
Isn't it nice? They didn't say, oh no, look, he's set up a new roving group that's not connected to any specific precinct to go around the city and do more work brutalizing demonstrators and squashing demonstrations and impeding people's free speech rights.
And a lot of my list, of course, overlapped with that, dealt with SPD, but I did have one other that was statewide, which is that the state's Republican Party has really become untethered to reality. And we saw that in the primary, and we also saw that with the gubernatorial candidate, Lauren Culp, who has still refused to concede to Jay Inslee, even though he lost by basically a 2-1 margin. It was a huge landslide for Inslee for a third term as governor. But Republican candidate Lauren Culp has been claiming without evidence, very similar to Donald Trump, that there was massive vote fraud and that he's the rightful winner. And you've got the state Republican Party going along with it. In the primary, you saw Tim Iman, who is, really been a bomb thrower for a couple of decades now, finished fourth. And the reason he finished fourth wasn't because he was too radical for the Republican Party. It's because he wasn't radical enough. So you've really seen one of the two major parties in this state become untethered to reality. And that has not been covered at all in local media as a real problem, because if you have a major party like that just is not functional, it creates all kinds of problems in the state legislature. It creates all kinds of problems in local governments in areas where Republicans have influence or have a majority. And there are very, very few sort of moderate Republicans anymore. The one statewide office that is held by a Republican is the Secretary of State, Kim Iman, who is who is a moderate Republican. And she has been heavily criticized by most Republicans in the state for not suppressing votes, for not going along with the idea that there was massive voter fraud, that Warren Culp is the rightful governor, et cetera. So it really is kind of disturbing, and we've kind of accepted it as normal now because we've seen that at the national level as well. So it's something that needs more attention from local media, and we're just not getting it.
Yeah, and we really need folks in local media to say, what's wrong with the state Republican Party? What are you doing? That may be the standard of your national party, but it's not the standard here in Washington State for how a major political party should behave.
Or it certainly shouldn't be.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so that.
So that wraps up my list and jobs list this year.
Yeah, and we will cover national and international next week, and there is a lot to talk about there too. So, stick around for that.
All right. Very good.
Okay, speaking of national for this week.
Oh, Lordy.
Let's do a COVID-19 update.
Well, there's a lot going on with the pandemic, as you might expect. Locally, probably the most important thing to know is that Jay Inslee extended the moratorium on evictions until March 31st. So, the housing crisis that Maria was referring to earlier, where you have a lot of people who can't make their rent and don't really have any other options, they have until March 31st at least now before that becomes a serious issue. So that's been punted down the road, which is a good thing. But
it does hit, there's a lot of people who are going to owe back rent who are not going to be able to pay it. And that's going to be a big issue. So we'll need to keep that in mind and be thinking about further legislation or further executive orders to try to help folks who owe that kind of back rent and can't pay it. Perhaps a rental amnesty program of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, as people fall farther and farther behind, you know, when the moratorium is lifted, it's all going to become due. And nationally, that's going to become a huge issue in a few days here, which
that the Biden
we'll talk about
administration is going to have to deal with, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. And Congress, hopefully.
Yeah. In other COVID-19 news, the National Institutes of Health this week announced that they're launching a study of allergic reactions to the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. They're going to be recruiting people who specifically have a history of severe allergies that have produced anaphylactic shock reactions in the past. And they're trying to do it as quickly as they can, obviously. Only the Pfizer vaccine will be studied initially. No severe reactions have yet been reported to the Moderna vaccine, which
that's not true. One came up yesterday in Boston.
Just yesterday, yeah. And the Moderna vaccine was just distributed this week, so it's a little early to have heard, but apparently that's also triggering some severe reactions too. And I just want to say that as of Sunday, over 500,000 healthcare workers have been inoculated with the Pfizer vaccine. It's more folks now that the Moderna vaccine has also been distributed this week.
It's over a million all total, which is really remarkable.
Good news.
For 10 days of distribution, that's really a remarkable mobilization.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And news came this week of a new UK variant of COVID-19 that may be highly transmissible, spreading 70% faster than previous variants. And I want to emphasize that this is what you risk when you want to rely on herd immunity, allowing the virus to infect as many people as possible. The more people who are infected, the more opportunities the virus has to mutate. The more mutations, the more likely one of those mutations will make the virus either more virulent, easier to transmit, or more deadly.
There have been two. They are related, but they are separate. There's one in the UK, and there's another in South Africa that is also highly transmissible.
Things may have arisen separately. Yeah. It appears that the UK variant, though, has spread already to Australia, Denmark, Italy, the Netherlands, other countries in Europe, to Japan, to Lebanon, and possibly may also be in South Africa, along with the other variant that they think may have arisen separately. Both of the variants, at least the UK variant is the one that I know more about, has targeted the spike protein, which is what the virus uses to invade human cells. That's the protein that is incorporated in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Apparently, the mutation isn't enough to change the spike protein in a way that would make the vaccines negate the vaccines, but that's always a possibility. So it's something to keep an eye on.
And we may now have that that variant in the United States as well. Mm-hmm. We just don't know because the United States is not well set up to test for that. So the fact that both Washington State and late in the week the United States cut off travel from the UK is probably too late in terms of preventing its spread to the United States, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing. I mean, not only are we not testing and doing contact tracing, we're just not doing great genetic testing or coordinated genetic testing of the different variants that may be around the United States, so we really don't know a whole lot about what variant is spreading quickly and how it's spreading.
We're also in terms of failures in the United States, we're getting a lot of reports now of shortages of PPEs in different hospitals.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just one of many problems that hospitals are running into. They're running into shortages of staff, shortages of ICU beds. Much of the state of California now has no ICU beds remaining, all of Southern California and the Central Valley. And, you know, it really is grim in a lot of parts of the country right now because, you know, after 10 months of this pandemic, the United States still is not prepared to deal with, large numbers of infections, even though for several months the official policy of the federal government has been herd immunity to get as many people infected as possible. We saw revelations this past week of emails to that effect from various people in and around the HHS that this was in fact the official policy, that they were just going to let the pandemic rip and get as many people infected as possible. And, the problem with that, of course, is that the mortality rate doesn't really change. So you're condemning a lot of people to needless death. And we're now well over 300,000 people dead in the United States as a result of this pandemic. And a lot of that was preventable. A lot of that is directly at the feet of the Trump administration and the messaging of the Trump administration, which has inspired a lot of people to ignore public health mandates. Mm-hmm. It really is tragic.
Yeah, it's been terrible. So, okay.
I'm really going to be happy when 2020 is over.
Yeah, me too. So let's talk for a quick minute about Biden's one cabinet appointee this week.
Yeah.
Miguel Cardona, Secretary of Education. He's the current Connecticut Commissioner of Education. He has a teaching background and has served as a principal. He's bilingual with Spanish as his first language and English as his second language. And he has a Master of Science in Bilingual and Bicultural Education from the University of Connecticut, where he also earned his doctorate in education. He has also served as an adjunct professor of education at the University of Connecticut's Department of Educational Leadership. He also has two children of his own who attend public schools. Biden described Cardona as a real easy choice, given his experience with getting Connecticut students connected with the equipment they need for online learning this year. Connecticut apparently provided all students with a laptop and home internet access who didn't already have it so that they could do remote learning. Biden has also promised that he would replace the odious and unqualified Betsy DeVos with a teacher. And Cardona is both a teacher and a strong advocate for public K-12 schools, while DeVos has done everything she can to favor private and religious schools. Cardona is a big proponent of access to educational resources for all students, including students of color, bilingual kids, LGBTQ students, and those who struggle with disabilities. That includes providing equal access to technology and STEM training to all students, not just students in wealthy school districts. His policies on higher education are unknown. That includes whether he would advocate for student loan forgiveness, something that many progressives have called for. He is an advocate for expanding access to higher learning to all students who want it, especially STEM and technological programs. Cardona is going to have a huge job ahead of him. Biden has promised to reopen schools within the first 100 days of his inauguration, and that's going to mean getting teachers vaccinated, virus-proofing schoolrooms, particularly their HVAC systems, providing PPE to teachers and students, and helping school districts that have seen steep budget cuts because of the economic downturn and the subsequent fall in tax revenue for state and local governments. And then there's also the emerging nationwide gap in learning that has happened this year, which will mean some students will be literally 1 year behind their peers when they return to school. Cardona is especially well suited to understand the learning gap, and he'll be expected to come up with some good ideas on how to close that gap once kids do return to school. So he's got a hard job ahead of him.
Yeah, I do think he's a generally positive pick.
I think he's a good pick.
It's going to require also some cooperation from Congress to get the kind of funding that's necessary to make up the gap and all the things that have been lost this past year. But hopefully that will happen, and he's a strong choice.
Yeah, and so of the positions left to fill, Attorney General is the big one, and other important Department of Justice staff like the Deputy Attorney General, the Associate Attorney General, and the Solicitor General. Biden's expected to announce those kind of in a group. And he's taken his time selecting his legal team. Rumors are that he might pick Merrick Garland, Obama's pick for the Supreme Court, who Senate Republicans refused to consider in 2016. Garland, however, is a former public prosecutor and DOJ official who's known to be highly deferential to law enforcement. His nomination, I think, would be a real problem for folks who want to see police reform efforts become more coordinated nationally by the Department of Justice. That's also true, I think, for the other two folks who are high on Biden's list. Former Alabama Senator Doug Jones and former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. I think of these three folks, Sally Yates is probably the best pick for civil rights advocates because of her prior experience as Deputy Attorney General during the Obama administration when criminal justice reform was a leading issue being tackled somewhat by the Department of Justice. She pushed for ending solitary confinement in federal prisons, for shutting down private federal facilities, which she actually did. And she pushed for sentencing reform. But I think she's going to have a heavy lift in the Senate if it's got a majority of Senate Republicans. So much depends on what happens with the Georgia elections come January 5th. And that could be why Biden is waiting to announce his attorney general pick. He wants to see how the Senate's going to go first. So we could either hear next week, or it may not be till January when we hear what his picks are for attorney general and his leading legal team. Now, also, Biden still has his business and labor team to pull together. That includes secretaries of commerce, labor, and the small business administrator. And then, of course, there is still the CIA director, which he hasn't announced yet. So we'll see if he announces any of those next week.
So moving on.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that major hack that happened to U.S. government systems. Many folks who are involved with investigating that in the government security agencies say it's the Russians. Donald Trump says it's the Chinese. I don't think it really matters. I think what mostly matters is just how really bad it is, and I want to talk about that.
Yeah, and I think I mean, it was covered certainly in mainstream media, but they had trouble covering it because it's a complicated thing to explain.
They don't understand it. I want to explain it in a way.
They don't understand how bad it is, and it's really bad.
Yeah, I want to explain it in a way so that people understand how bad it is. Initially, they said it was email systems. Well, it's not just email systems. What we're talking about is a company like SolarWinds who make a software product called Orion. And what this software does is it's for IT managers and IT departments to install and use to get to monitor and manage network systems all across a company. So say, for example, you're a large multinational Fortune 500 company that has offices all over the United States, and each office in each city has its own server stack, not one server, but multiple servers in a stack. How do you know what's going on in an office clear across the country if you don't have one software package that can see the entire network in all your different facilities all over the country? And that's what the Orion software does. It allows you to monitor and to maintain all of your different server stacks. Well, that piece of software would be a rich target for hackers, right? Because if they get into your Orion software, they can see and do anything they want all over your network, all over the country, right? So what happened is hackers got into SolarWinds systems and they installed malware in a security patch that was pushed out for the Orion software from SolarWinds, which is the trusted vendor, right? That's what IT departments refer to as the nightmare scenario. You can harden your systems all you want. You can close all the ports in your system that you want. You can force all of the folks who log into your network to have strong passwords and strong user credentials. But the nightmare scenario is if a trusted software vendor pushes out a security patch or a security update to their software that has malware in it. And that's exactly what happened. That malware allowed hackers to get into multiple departments in the U.S. government, including the State Department, the Justice Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the Pentagon, the NSA, and the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where nuclear research occurs, and to the systems of probably the majority of Fortune 500 companies in the United States, including utility companies, banks and brokerage houses, you name it. Hackers could get into any systems they wanted. They could make up and they could steal and or make up user credentials, and they could install their own back doors so that if the Orion software was removed from a network system, they would still have a way in. So really, the only way that a company could make sure that they've locked the hackers completely out of their system would be to replace every single piece of hardware and every single piece of software running on that hardware throughout their corporation or throughout their agency. So essentially, that's how big and how bad the hack is. It really is the nightmare scenario. And that's not something you're hearing in the press. The mainstream press keeps talking about it like it's email hacks, because I guess that's what they know from the past, that, oh gosh, Russians hacked the emails for the Democratic National Committee. So that's what they're talking about, is, oh, it's an email hack. That's not what it is at all. That is not what it is at all.
And it had been going on for a number of months.
Since March.
Most of this year. Yeah. You know, the only way to fix it would be to replace all of the computer systems. And we're talking about that for the U.S. government. And we're also talking about that for a number of the country's largest corporations. It really is a huge, huge problem.
It's huge. It's the nightmare scenario. And what's amazing is that nobody in the federal government, particularly in the Trump White House, is really talking about it in those terms and is really trying to reassure anyone that they're pursuing, trying to pursue the hackers, much less accurately identify who they were, or close the loopholes. Nor are they talking about the resources needed to close that loophole.
Exactly, because it would require an awful lot of money to fix this, and nobody's talking about that at all.
Yeah,
certainly not in Congress, and especially not in the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I find reassuring about it is that what I know about the Treasury Department and the IRS, you know, the way that the U.S. government takes in money in order to run the federal government, is that the Treasury Department has the oldest computer systems in the federal government, and they have multiple computer systems that don't really talk well to each other. So in a way, because their computer systems are so outdated, they're kind of hack-proof. So that's the one reassuring thing I see in this. But everything else, including our whole national security system, is entirely compromised. And that happened under the Trump administrations. It happened on Donald Trump's watch, and he's bears responsibility for it and has not taken responsibility for it and has not even really talked about it other than to gripe about how it's the Chinese, it's their fault, the China virus, blah, 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 I think, which proves that he's either probably the stupidest person to have ever been president of the United States or has some serious cognitive issues.
All of the above,
yeah.
All right, we've just got a couple minutes left.
Well, let's talk about COVID relief. It's probably dead. Today would actually be the last Monday, rather, would be the last day practically to do it, because what happens, and Trump has decamped for Florida, and there's no indication from his schedule that he's ever going back to D.C. He's certainly not going to attend the inauguration, and he may well stay in Florida and just keep golfing until January 20th. Mike Pence, of course, is in Vail, Colorado, and there's really been a complete abdication of trying to do anything to help the American public when you've got unemployment benefit extensions set to expire, the moratorium eviction is set to expire, and you've got just people needing the package, inadequate as it was, that Congress passed after, endless amounts of negotiation, including with the White House and with Steven Mnuchin. But Trump is refusing to sign it, and all he has to do is absolutely nothing. And if he doesn't sign it within 10 days, what happens, it's called a pocket veto, and it goes back to Congress. Well, the problem with that is that the 10 days goes through January 4th, and Congress changes on January 3rd. The new Congress comes in from the November election, and so Congress would have to start all over on brand new legislation if Trump does nothing, and it looks a lot like that's what's going to happen. Which is just shockingly irresponsible. But he's doing it apparently out of a fit of petulance, because he's mad at Mitch McConnell, because McConnell recognized that Biden won the election. That is why he's hanging millions and millions of Americans out to dry.
All right. Any events this week?
Yes. Something I want to highlight, especially for people in the South Sound who might be listening. Yesterday, Tacoma Housing Now, which is a homelessness advocacy group, occupied a vacant travel lodge in Fife, near the port of Tacoma. Theme being no room at the inn, and the idea being to try and house people in Pierce County, especially unhoused people who are vulnerable to or have been exposed to or actually have COVID-19. And they are asking people to come down to Fife and help defend that occupation today, today being Saturday. So that is at 3518 Pacific Highway East in Fife. It's right near the Port of Tacoma. And folks are defending that and trying to make that available to unhoused people. So please go down there and help those folks out. It's a direct action that that is badly needed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. So we will have to continue this the same time next week.
Oh, we will.
We will. We'll be here.